When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Well, that wasn't quite the return back to league action that we all expected and anticipated for Norwich City. You spend 2 weeks waiting like Temu Pukki to be played through at Wembley, and you get served up an afternoon of frustration in South Wales. Welcome back to the Pinkin.com Norwich City podcast. I'm your host, Connor Southwell, joined by Paddy Davitt and Samuel Seaman to reflect and try and make sense of everything that happened in Swansea yesterday. Another defeat for Norwich and another day where probably, as I think will be the case throughout this season and particularly the early part of this season, where you have some ups that feel intoxicating and some downs that feel really like heavy blows. And this was definitely the latter of those, but probably for reasons of Norwich City's own making. Paddy, let's start with you. As I said, frustration, certainly the overriding emotion, probably. And we had plenty of time to stew on it with that journey home, as the 750 Norwich fans will testify. It's a long old poke, that, to South Wales. And I think probably the major thing is, and certainly my reflection is, when Norwich City get beaten by a team that's better than them or has outplayed them on the day, I think there is probably a feeling you can kind of accept that to an extent. It's never nice. And of course, nobody of a Norwich City persuasion ever wants that to be the case. But you can accept that when it is... basically, as we saw yesterday, where Norwich City beat themselves, ultimately, that's probably what makes this more frustrating to take.
Yeah, wouldn't disagree with that, Connor. I've just literally, as we about to record, I've just been working through the Johannes quotes, so to actually be fresh in my mind, and more or less that's how he's broken it down. You know, I'll read them. Far better to hear from what the man himself said than me paraphrasing. I mean, he basically, on that point, he said, trying not to be too disrespectful, because I think Swansea did well. I think they made a good performance. But we lost due to us, because we didn't perform, especially in the first half, where we don't have control of the game. And that's the theme all through his post-match quotes. And we know how much that control element, how intrinsic it is in terms of Torup and how he wants Norwich to go about the task in the Championship, home or away, irrespective. He still wants to be able to try and control games even away. We don't take care of our chances. We invite them in with, of course, silly goal was his phraseology, and we'll get into that in due course. And then he goes on to talk about what annoys him the most is the performance, because he has high expectations that this is, especially what they did in the first half, not good enough. I think second half was okay. We didn't concede many chances, but we have to look into how we can convert some of those chances that we do create. And, of course, we won't pile in on Borja Sainz, but he was in the eye of that in terms of he had four chances from 84th minute onwards. Two at least were very good chances, and hasn't taken them. That's the clinical edge that Johannes is referring to. And that's why it's a 1-0 defeat and a self-inflicted one at that in terms of the goal they conceded, rather than, at worst, a draw, which, given those chances at the end, which for me probably masked, although Johannes was happier with the control element in that second half, I thought there was a distinct lack of chances created up until that burst. But that's why we're now dissecting a 1-0 defeat and a frustration generally, because after Coventry, I don't think that was, we all hoped, going to be the next step. But maybe if we zoom out, you touched on it there, Connor, it's kind of where we're going to be for the foreseeable, that you'll have these almost incremental steps and then maybe a regression, maybe a bit of treading water, maybe a bit of frustration. And that was all encapsulated with what we saw at Swansea on Saturday.
Yeah, it does have a feel of sort of two steps forward, one back, doesn't it? I think about it all. And you look at the two sort of 1-0 win at Coventry, 1-0 defeat at Swansea. It's margins, essentially. Norwich took their one shot on target at Coventry and didn't take many of the ones that they had against Swansea. But Sam, we kind of spoke about this on the way home. It's the type of game, and Paddy referenced it, about where Norwich City are at the moment. Last season, they had games like this where perhaps they didn't play very well, or they were really struggling to create anything, but they had players who were capable of producing moments. You look at Gabriel Sara, Borja Sainz has and did on occasion, John Rowe as well. Because of where this team is at the moment, there's fewer of those players, and that means it's probably more reliant on the collective chance creation, the collective making better opportunities for players who maybe aren't of the same standing or quality at this moment in time. And that is why probably Norwich City are going to get afternoons and games like this, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's majorly the concern when you have such a sort of a system set up that's designed around very specific tactical things playing out and everyone working together in a certain way. I think that means that quite often there's only one way really that you can score goals or that you can create significant chances. And there are positives to that. And, you know, we've spoken a lot about the need for identity at Carrow Road, and Torup and Napa have both spoken about the fact that they want fans to be able to recognise what they see from their team. But pretty much all of the goals we've seen from Norwich so far this season have come from the one source, which, to be fair, has been quite an attractive one in terms of those quicker passing moves, creating chances. But it does feel like when things aren't working, that they don't have somebody who can produce a moment in a different way. They also don't really have that same set-piece potency that maybe they did last season. And to be honest, given some of the individuals they still have in that team, you'd argue that's probably something they should be improving on and should be working on. But there definitely feels like a sort of smaller diversity of opportunities for Norwich at the moment and in this current setup. And I felt like that was, laid pretty bare at Swansea, to be honest. I mean, they did still create a couple of chances. And in those last 10 minutes or so, Paddy referenced the chances for Borja Sainz. I think he'll be disappointed. And I think it did feel like Norwich had a good few opportunities to get a point that maybe they didn't deserve based on their performance. So I think it was a combination of factors. Torup has been open about the fact that he'd like to see the team create more chances. And I think that's something that I've seen from fans as well, and an experience from speaking to them outside grounds, that they feel there still is a bit of a lack of sharpness in the final third. And I think you can see from the substitutions, the starting lineups that Torup has put out in the last few games, that there are still some issues in those attacking areas that Norwich need to work on. But, and I'm sure we'll come on to this. We were speaking going into the season about it being a transitional one. You mentioned two steps forward, one step back. I think as much as in isolation it was a disappointing performance, it also was a broader reminder of the fact that this probably is what Norwich are at the moment. And although everyone saw that Coventry win as maybe a springboard, and I'm sure that's how the players and the staff wanted to use that, ultimately it feels like it is going to be a bit inconsistent this season. And I think you now look at it as a 5-game block rather than a 4-game block leading into this triumphant Coventry win that felt like a turning point. And it feels probably slightly more like that transitional sort of mixed season that I think a lot of people were predicting going into it. So, yeah, a few issues for Norwich to iron out. But I think in the bigger picture, there are reasons to sort of stay calm. And I'm sure the Norwich fans will, given a couple of days to rest up after that long trip and to probably calm down a little bit after what was a pretty disappointing afternoon.
Yeah, I agree. And I think this is increasingly becoming a conversation about chance creation and attacking. I mean, jump in if you boys disagree with me, but I feel in terms of on the ball, they're doing some pretty good stuff. I think defensively, as Torup said in those quotes that you listed, Paddy, that defensively they're not really conceding many. I know Angus Gunn made a couple of good saves yesterday, but we're not talking about real clear-cut chances consistently. But you look at the chances that Norwich City created yesterday, and you're right, Paddy, in terms of what you said. So Josh Sargent had a, and I'm going purely on how these are ranked by expected goals, which is essentially a metric that that grades the quality of chances. So Josh Sargent had one in the fifth minute, which was graded at 0.23 as an opportunity. From that in the fifth minute to the 84th minute, the next best chance they created in what we're looking at, eight shots on goal that they had, some of them blocked, was Marcelino Nunez, also in the fifth minute, that was graded at 0.13. So that goes to show probably the struggles that Norwich City are having with their chance creation on a consistent basis. And the frustration is, Paddy, that, you know, as we've spoken about probably pretty liberally on this podcast, in terms of possession, they get themselves up to the final third pretty well. There are moments where they work promising opportunities. There were countless moments yesterday where they had 3-on-3. They even had overloads at points. It was 4-on-3, but it was just that final bit of quality, that final decision that was lacking. And I think that is probably why we're sat here probably feeling really frustrated, and why Norwich fans will be sat here feeling really frustrated about what they saw yesterday, because despite the 1-0 defeat, this could have been and probably should have been so much different. Even still then, I think we'd be talking about maybe this not being the best Norwich City performance.
Yeah, and I guess if we're in the interest of the glass half full side of this debate and positivity, then you can see that there's a pathway to getting to a point where all those elements continue in games, but the most crucial element, i.e. chance conversion, they add that. Now, whether that is shuffling around the individuals and the personnel and the positions on the pitch, or, you know, whether that's another window or two to bring in those type of players and that caliber of player. So that will play out in due course. But and it is a bit of a cliche, but managers and strikers actually always say, don't they, it's the time to worry is when you're not creating the chances and you're not, if you're a striker, putting yourself in those positions, because then you don't really see any light at the end of that tunnel. Whereas, you know, they clearly are creating chances, and it was just, you talk about a poor decision at the wrong time or the poor execution. And I think that's, there's almost a lack of calmness and a composure. And that only comes, I guess, from maybe a little bit of maturity, maybe players who feel that they're in a rhythm and in a groove. And you have to, you know, stress that we're 4 or 5 games into a 46 game journey. This is only the start, really. So it's probably unrealistic to expect. And of course, punctuated by a 2-week international break, which Torup wasn't using as an excuse, but they are the facts of the matter that for 2 weeks they've had half the squad away and the other half sort of ticking over. It's not ideal. It's not conducive to harnessing that momentum from Coventry and building on it again if you were going back in on the Tuesday after Cov rather than 2 weeks down the track. So they're the cards they were dealt. They've had to deal with those. But I think more broadly, yeah, I certainly wouldn't be in a camp that, this is now looking over the shoulder and we're in the teeth of a likely relegation battle or anything skirmishing at the bottom end of the table. I think it's very far from that. But in terms of how quickly they can accelerate along the path where they all believe that they're trying to take this club, whether it's Torup and his coaching staff, the players, it's Ben Napper and his recruitment types, and Neil Adams, even higher than them now, Mark Attanasio, Norfolk Holdings. We all know what the end point is, and it's putting the fundamentals in place, and that isn't going to happen in the space of a 4 or 5 game league block. It's completely unrealistic to expect that. But I think there's certainly enough evidence, and even yesterday in defeat, that a lot of the things that will be needed to be baked in to get Norwich where they want to get to are starting to come through. But, you know, it's just the frustration, I guess, is that you see in a player like Borja Sainz, and this isn't by any manner means meant to single him out, but there's clearly a player there who has the talent and the technical ability to score goals and assists, dare I say, in Gabby Zara levels, but not in the here and now, clearly, because he is still, you know, very young in terms of his career path, and really only one season under his belt in England, and that was up and down. Let's be honest, there was good moments, there was less good moments. So to feel that he's the finished article would be unrealistic, but, you know, at some point the dial does need to shift, and if it's him, if it's Cernach, Swartow, these players, Forsen, you know, they need to come in and need to show us a little bit more than they are doing, albeit it is very, very early in their Norwich careers and their paths in England. So, again, it's not it's not something any fan or probably anybody connected to the media really wants to have rammed down their throats, but it is about patience and it is about understanding this is a process. You can't really short-circuit the process. There are probably accelerants that Torup and his coaching staff and Napa and his team can do over the course of these next few months, but it might just be a case of this is an evolutionary thing we're now embarking on, and there will be feelings of, like Coventry, an acceleration, and then obviously then maybe the brakes get applied a little bit when you get a Swansea-type result and performance, certainly in the first half, so or second half for me, in terms of chance creation. So, yeah, it's not probably realistic, but you still hope that it comes together a lot quicker and that they embark on almost, to keep going back to this Farker-Webber parallel, that they almost can circumvent the 17-18 season and we get straight to 18-19. I think the reality is, in a championship as competitive as this, with clubs who have their own ambitions and in many respects probably more financial resources right now at their disposal, that's unrealistic. So, it's more of what we probably felt at the start of the season before a ball was kicked, that it's going to be incremental and it's going to be evolutionary. And, you know, nobody really can say with any certainty, whether it's outside the camp or inside the camp, how soon it comes together. You just hope that what they're putting in place are fundamentals and guiding principles that will, at some point, bring Norwich to a period where they are very competitive in terms of that top six, maybe even top two push for the championship, because that's why Torup is here, that's why Napa's come in, that's why Attanasio and his group are deepening their involvement. They've not come in here to tread water in the championship. They want to get to the Premier League. They want to stay there. So that's the end goal, and everything they're doing now is designed to, hopefully move them along that path at a speed where the fan base can see that this progress is there, that they can buy into it, they can stay even in the periods where it's a little bit fallow and it's a little bit frustrating, because they can see that the bigger picture is and the underlying signs are healthy.
Yeah, and I think what you've mapped out there is true of some performances as well, and some moments. And Sam spoke about this. I think when they score certain goals, you sit back and think, "Wow, this is wonderful what they're trying to do." And there are also points where it looks quite lateral and it looks quite ponderous, and those chances aren't there. And that is the nature of going through the process that they're going through. And I'm glad you mentioned Daniel Farker there, Pad, and it's almost like we planned it. We hadn't. Whilst you were speaking there, I was actually looking at those two seasons, both 17-18 and 18-19, the first five games. How many points did they accrue? Well, I'll tell you, in the 17-18 campaign, which obviously his first one in charge, they had a 1-1 draw. This is the first five games only. They had a 1-1 draw against Fulham, a 3-1 defeat against Sunderland. They beat QPR 2-0. They lost to Aston Villa 4-2. And then, of course, that now infamous 4-0 defeat at Millwall. So they picked up 4 points from five games. 18-19, same points return. 2-2 draw against Birmingham, a 4-3 defeat to West Brom, 2-1 defeat to Sheffield United, a 2-0 win over Preston, which I think Alex Tetti scored a screamer, but in general had a pretty bad day in terms of his performance from memory, and a 3-0 defeat to Leeds. So they also got 4 points in five games. And to flip that on the other side, you look at last season. They beat in the first five games. They beat Hull 2-1. They drew 4-4 at Southampton. It was a 3-1 win against Millwall. They beat Huddersfield 4-0. They lost to Rotherham. So they had, 10 points from the opening five games. So what does that show you? It probably shows at this stage of the season, we can't say with any real certainty about where this goes from here. And equally, it probably proves that the opening five games are not necessarily indicative of where Norwich City are going to head. Obviously, that 18-19 campaign, they then went on to win the title, not at a counter, but pretty close to that. Last season, they fell off a cliff, and we all know how that transpired, obviously, throughout the rest of the campaign. So that provides, I think, Sam, a little bit of context about what you said, about why it's important probably to remain quite level, just to remain a little bit calm. It's a defeat, and defeats inevitably across a 46-game season happen anyway, but particularly in the state where Norwich are at, and Paddy maps it out there, where they've got a lot of new signings. You only have to look at the churn over the summer, 8 in, 9 out. A lot of that is young. It's a young group. They're adapting to a new style of play, and actually probably the conversation that we've had around structure and style of play, a lot of them are still getting used to that and probably up to speed with that. And I also think in terms of coaching, I've never taken a session in my life, so I've listened to people who are and do, and you listen to them generally, and they say that is the hardest part. It's it's teaching a team and coaching a team to be really slick from an offensive perspective. So the fact that that's probably the final bit shouldn't come really as any surprise.
No, and I think it probably is important to look at those seasons, not only in terms of the first few games, but across the board, really. A 1-0 loss to Swansea on an off afternoon after an international break is not a result that any team is immune to, really. I'm sure there will be plenty of championship winning and promotion winning campaigns for Norwich and other teams that have included various results like this one. So, I mean, that's not me saying Norwich are going to go and win the league and that this is just going to be a bad day that we're looking back on next summer. But I think it does give a bit of context, and it's not indicative of how Norwich are going to look now for the rest of the season. You know, I think it when you see it against Oxford, and that is 100% of the sample size of Norwich in the Championship this season, then I can understand it. But we've seen between the two defeats this season some pretty positive performances, some pretty good things. And like you say, it does feel like, especially in the build-up and defensively, sort of the back four and the deeper phases of midfield play, Norwich are looking pretty good, and they've adapted pretty well to life under Johannes Hoftorup. But I can see why people are concerned in the final third. As you said, it's a lot of it is about getting people used to it. And you've got a few new players in there who are still working on combining with each other and learning the movements that each of their teammates will make. That is a hard element to add to a team. But also I can understand why people are concerned, because there are some elements of it that don't really feel like they're new players getting used to the environment or dealing with the new physicality of English football or getting used to each other. A lot of it, to be honest, has been simple passes, controlling the ball well in tight areas, just technical strength, really. And you look at the likes of Emmanuel Forsen, Ante Sienatz, I'd argue even Oscar Schwartau in that bracket probably yesterday. And I can understand that people are worried, because it doesn't feel like it's them adapting or developing a tactical understanding. It feels like actually these are poor performances where players just aren't really showing the levels of talent that I think a lot of fans were hoping to see, when you see the work that Ben Napper has done this summer and some of the fees that were paid for these players. So for me, there are still some concerning elements, maybe regardless of the fact that there is a bit of a transitional element to it. I think there's still a task for Torup to find the solution in that right wing position, which seems to me, I suppose if you're looking at it optimistically, as a position that's up for the taking there, really up for grabs. And there will be a few players who will feel that they've got a claim to stake in that area. But also at this stage of the season, to have no real feeling of the pecking order or the best possible solution in that position is a bit of a worry. And yeah, there are structural solutions that need to be found. There are problems that will be solved with time.
Well, we've lost you there, Sam, I think, in terms of sound. If we got you back. No, we haven't got Sam out. We'll let him sort his audio out. And Paddy, I'll come to you on the next point. And it is interesting. Sam mentioned the right wing. It's a shame. So I was gonna ask him about that. So I'll come back to that once he sorted his audio out. But in terms of what he was saying there about maybe the technical errors, and I think this probably goes back to maybe where we started this podcast, really, in terms of speaking about Norwich City effectively beating themselves. I mean, I've had a look at the numbers this morning, and in terms of even Norwich being dispossessed, so obviously the number of times a player loses control of the ball by being tackled or whatnot, and then you throw missed controls in as well, which is obviously the number of times a player failed when attempting to gain control of the ball. I've added those two numbers together, and it comes to 33 occasions across that 90 minutes that Norwich City either miscontrolled the ball or were dispossessed. If you want an individual breakdown, it was 18 times they were dispossessed and 15 times they were miscontrolled. Both of those is the highest number in any game this season, League or Cup. So that probably epitomises this whole debate that we've been having, really, particularly around their offensive play. And I remember I said to you, there was so we were fortunate, we were in a bit of a different position at Swansea Stadium stadium yesterday, a bit of a higher one, which was quite nice. But equally, we had little monitors, and at halftime, they sort of scroll through some statistics, and I don't know what this number ended up at, but at half time it showed sort of Norwich's pass completion in the final third, and that was at 53%. So we're talking basically at one in two passes in the final third being completed. Therein, when you dig into those numbers, sort of underlines this whole conversation, doesn't it, about Norwich City's individual errors probably costing them on this occasion.
Yeah, I don't want you to put the names out there, but you've on that breakdown of turnovers and miscontrols, I mean, have you got the individuals involved as well? I'm pretty sure I know who the ones were. Yeah,
I can find them if you keep talking.
Well, no, we don't really need to throw them under the proverbial, but I mean, it was pretty clear to me that.
Do you want them? I've got them in front of me.
I think we might have already heard their names in the last segment. I think Sam referenced a couple of the two young midfielders. I'm pretty sure would be very high on that pecking order because
it is quite interesting. So in terms of miscontrols, let's look at this. So Borja Sainz had five, Oscar Schwartau with four, Forsen with three, and then you've got McLean, Krizene, and Sargent all with one. In terms of dispossessed, again, Science 3, Krizene 3, Stacey 3, Shortow 2, Sargent 2, Forsen 1, McLean, Duffy, Nunez, and Sienach all with one as well. So again, we're probably looking at offensive players again in this sort of conversation with those numbers.
Which cuts to the annoyance, to paraphrase, that Johannes had with the performance, because he knows those players are better than what they showed in those facets in terms of controlling the ball, in terms of making the right decisions. And when you know you've got raw material in terms of your individuals on the pitch who are better than that, and you collectively and individually get those metrics that you've referenced, you know, championship worst so far this season in key areas of your offensive strategy, then, of course, as a coach, that would be hugely frustrating because he knows those players are better than that. And he will drill down, and I'm sure him and his coaches, as to what were the factors behind that. You know, was it team selection? Was it what he was asking them to do? Was it how it melded together? You know, Swansea, conversely, I worked them up this morning, Sunday morning. You can go and have a look on the Pinken. Luke Williams, I thought, was very illuminating that he said that, again, paraphrasing, if you allow Norwich to sort of get set and pass you around, then you're in for a long afternoon. So he was... it's felt like the biggest factor in his game plan was front foot aggressive from the off and really pin Norwich back and almost knock them out of their stride. And if you're a Forsen new to England, if you're a Schwartau new to England, almost metaphorically give them a clout round the ear, and to the point where they're so dizzy that, well, what is this all about? I'm not used to this style of football. This isn't my background. I can't almost catch my breath metaphorically. And that was very much how they started. And in the midst of that barrage, 4 minutes in, you have a catalogue of individual errors from Norwich players culminating, unfortunately, in Forsen lucklessly putting the ball past Angus Gunn. So, you know, fair play to Luke Williams. But for me, moving forward, he won't be the only championship manager who looks at Norwich and looks at Torup and what they're trying to do and tries to counteract them in the same way. So Norwich are going to have to problem solve a lot better than they did yesterday. And that's not just players on the pitch. That's Johannes and his coaching staff. And that's a reminder as well that he's relatively new to the division and learning what the championship's all about and the different challenges that teams are going to pose to try and nullify, which is what he's trying to do conversely, to impose his style of play. So there's no doubt Norwich were very uncomfortable in that initial phase with that high aggressive press, and it broke down. And maybe that was... albeit they kind of weathered that, and obviously Swansea's intensity died a little bit after that first 15-20 minutes. But really, that first half, everything you've discussed at the start of this segment, was palpably and painfully evident that Norwich's play, even allowing for two or three turnover opportunities, which were very good opportunities, certainly better than they fashioned for the majority of the second half until Sainz moved centre stage. But overall, a lot of their play in that first half was careless and was imprecise. And, you know, when you're a team who want to control, that word that Johannes kept referencing again after the game, he wants to control games, he wants to do that with possession, and you're not good enough on the ball, then it's going to break down, isn't it? So that's, you know, understandable why he felt that it was rather that Swansea beat them, it was they beat themselves yesterday.
Yeah, and I would agree with that assessment. Sam, just check in, have we got you back?
I hope so. Can you hear me?
There we go. Yes, we can. Excellent. Right. I was going to ask you anyway about sort of the right wing situation, because I think you were in the midst of kind of talking about that a little bit. And I agree. It feels like it's becoming an area of certainly feels definitely up for grabs, but maybe an area of where a resolution is needed. It was Oscar Schwartau ahead of Antti Siinach there yesterday. What do you make of that, and how do you see it developing? Because again, the way that Norwich play it, it's almost like it's sort of an inverted role, isn't it? They want to get sort of players in half spaces, obviously, with then Jack Stacey providing width. How do you sort of see that unfolding? Because I think it's fair to say that both Siinach, who actually I felt did offer some nice touches when he came on, but I'm sort of clutching a little bit, and Oscar Schwartau probably didn't take the opportunity that was ahead of him. Equally, again, context, he's an 18-year-old lad who's new to England, so I think, you know, it should be no one sort of writing him off after that, because he has shown some bright displays elsewhere. But how do you sort of see this unfolding, particularly now Kay Gordon is in the building as well? We obviously didn't see him yesterday, and I thought it was quite interesting how Norwich chased the game with a back three and wing backs. Does that provide maybe a solution to the whole thing?
Yeah, I think there are loads of different elements at play, really. I think the wing backs one felt more like a late attempt at getting back into the game from Torup. I'd be surprised, given how wedded he has been to his sort of trademark ideology, if he considered going away from that longer term. It feels to me like, in terms of how he sees it, I think he still believes that Siinach will come good, and not necessarily just in the mid to longer term, which I think obviously a lot of people will be willing to give him time in that sense, because he's only 20, he's only just arrived in the country. But I think from his team selections and his substitutions and the way that he's spoken about him, I think there is still a decent level of belief from Torup that Siinach can impact things in the short term and in the next few weeks. It feels to me like if anyone's got a slight advantage, and admittedly that is a very marginal one given how some of the performances have been, I would say that Siinach is probably that man. And I think tactically it's an idea that could work in different ways. You've got Jack Stacey as a right back who, as everyone is well aware, loves to bomb on down the outside, and Torup likes to have wingers who come inside. At least he has done that typically at Nordsjælland, usually with one of them. And I think Schwartau and Siinach both tactically suit that quite well. Obviously, Siinach likes to come inside on that left foot. He likes to have shots from distance, and theoretically that should create space for Stacey. But I think the problem for him, as I spoke about earlier, has been actually just simple technical quality and maybe not being at his best on the ball. And then Schwartau, I think they've got a bit of a problem there, because for me, he does have a bit more physicality than certainly you'd expect from an 18-year-old coming from the Danish league and playing in English football for the first time. But I still don't feel that he's at his best with his back to goal, which is a lot of how he's receiving the ball at the moment. He obviously doesn't want to stick to the touchline, and that's not the role that's being asked of him, where normally if you're a winger, if you want to face the play, if you want to get a defender one-on-one, that's the easiest place to find the space and a fairly easy area to get the ball to as well, compared to those sort of number 10 positions which Schwartau tends to operate in. I think if they can find a way of getting him facing the play a bit more often, maybe trying to create looking at the opposition goal rather than, you know, up against a more experienced Championship defender and in the sort of physical battle that Paddy referenced Swansea gave him yesterday, I think that he could also work in that role. But I think both of those have those issues. Probably the Siinach one is easier to solve, or at least simpler to solve, because they will still believe that he's a good technical footballer who can improve on those technical performances. But there are obviously issues that right now you'd say both of those have. And going into Watford, it's difficult to believe that if one of those two starts in the right wing position, it's difficult to say that you feel confident they're going to be a key player in solving those attacking issues for Norwich. But you also referenced Kate Gordon, obviously now part of the group, on the bench for the first time yesterday. He's had a few days training, and I wonder if that came into Torup's thinking a little bit. Obviously was away with the England Elite League squad during the international break as well. So I wonder if he's considered the fact that he hasn't really spent much time around his teammates. But ultimately, this is somebody who they brought in as a bit of a wild card from Liverpool, as somebody who probably, although there has been diligent scouting going on, they don't quite know 100% what level he's at and whether he can be a key player for Norwich. So I think situations like yesterday are probably the sort of situations that he'll be tested in first and foremost. And although we didn't see him yesterday, I think there were reasons for that. So yeah, if Torup maybe needs that wild card in future, and you'd suggest he may do if these problems persist in the final third, that Gordon might be that man. But right now it does feel like nobody's really taken up that mantle and grasped the opportunity that is there. I think the good news is that there are still options. Obviously, Torup hasn't exhausted all of them. We spoke about Gordon. Ono Hernandez hasn't started a league game yet this season either. So there are a few options to exercise and to try out. It's probably an area that's causing a little bit of concern. But right now, I'd say that Torup probably has two or three or four more options before he's exhausted them, and he's looking around wondering whether that's going to be a problem position until sort of January at least.
I'd like to see Shortow as one of the three. I think one of the central three. I think for the reasons you've said there, get the game in front of him, that ability to arrive late into the box. I think they need a bit more of a goal threat from midfield. I think he could provide that, and I think you're probably getting him in positions to receive the ball, which are much better and much more suited to his ability. So I wonder if that becomes a potential solution, particularly maybe given where Forson's at the moment, which Paddy probably leads us on to the goal. And ironically, I guess it was probably the best finish of the afternoon from a Norwich City perspective, because he ran onto that and picked his spot beautifully. But the own goal more generally, that clearly is going to be frustrating. And I think the fact of the position and where it comes, you know, we've spoken a lot about maybe what Norwich have done in possession. This was just a mix-up, wasn't it, in the right sort of the right back position. Kenny McLean gets stuck with the ball. I think he initially tried to see it out of play and it just didn't have the pace. He then had to sort of step, and you spoke about Swansea's press. They pin him in well, and I think he probably needed support from Stacey to sort of come to him and almost allow him to bounce their way out of it. But instead, Stacey tried to stretch it. There's a miscommunication. McLean plays the ball. I think whether he thinks Stacey is maybe fainting to create space for himself, I don't know. But it wasn't ideal. And probably, even though I think Forson's name obviously is on the score sheet, not a whole host that he could do about that goal. But with him more generally, after sort of a little chat about the goal, what do you make of where he is at the moment? Because after what was an electric start, like that cup game against Stevenage, I think he's shown a nice touch, obviously, for Josh Sargent in the Sheffield United game. It does feel like maybe his levels have dropped. Is that natural? Is that, partly as a result of what happened at Palace? Because it feels to me like maybe that's an event that, I don't know if it's not the confidence out of him, but he's looked certainly physically a lot less able. We saw probably a low centre of gravity in the first few weeks, and he was able to ride challenges quite well, and he seems to have lost that a little bit. And there was an interesting moment, and you wrote about this in your pointers, just before the second half, where he came out from the tunnel and Glenn Riddlesholm had his arm around him and almost was giving him words of encouragement as well. So probably a player that is just maybe not quite in form at this moment in time.
No, there's a lot to unpack there, Connor, but you know, you've got a 21-year-old, same as Cernach in that regard, you know, transported from Salzburg to England and the English Championship. You know, it's quite a culture shock, I'm sure, and all the off the pitch that goes with trying to settle into a new country. And of course, there was the Crystal Palace injury. That looked a bad injury on the night, but his powers of recovery, and it was a testament to his character and his indomitable spirit, almost, that he declared himself fit. I mean, there was a funny anecdote. I think we were told that, you know, that was done the, I'm going to say, was it a Tuesday night or Wednesday night? And then Thursday, he was there reporting Brighton early for training and he was ready to go again. And they were almost, Torup couldn't quite believe that he was, you know, fit for duty that swiftly. So that's a good sign that that's the type of character he is, that, you know, he wants to come in, he wants to contribute, he wants to be already a main player. But I think you're almost having to save himself from himself a little bit, that he is that very young, and particularly as well where he plays on the pitch, and also within a Torup template. There's a lot of demands placed on midfielders in this template, and that's why I think we saw when Slimani came in, and we'll get into him in due course here, but when he came in that cameo at Coventry, it was night and day, just in terms of a player who is a little bit further along in his development. He's like 3 years older. He's played a bit more football. Obviously, he was recruited by Sheffield to go in at Premier League level. So that's the grade of player they thought they were acquiring this time last year. And just alongside McLean, alongside Nunes at Cov in that second half, there was far more control, far more composure, far more understanding, I think, technically of the position that he was, that player in that area of the pitch is asked to execute. And obviously, the technical ability was there as well from Slimani. Now, Forsen, for me, feels like a project. He could go on to be that type of player in a Torrox system. But I don't think in the here and now he is the answer. I don't think he's the finished article by a long way. And why would he be? You know, as I say, you know, he's a very young man making his way in the game. And it's probably unfortunate. And it's probably the way the fates have conspired that he's had to go in there. And he was good. To be fair, as much as Oxford was a write-off, he was the shining light. You know, he came in, he looked very composed. And in a game that felt like it was in reverse for a long period of time for Norwich generally that day, you know, he did look like somebody who could put their foot on the ball. He was good in those small, tight spaces. And of course, he followed up then a few days later, Stevenage in the League Cup, where he was excellent on the ball. You know, I know it was Stevenage, I know it was the League Cup, but in terms of taking the ball in, finding players, the weight of pass, the timing of passes, and, you know, just popped into my head again, that excellent touch for Sargent to set him away to score against Sheffield United. That was a high calibre piece of midfield play and instinctively, technically aware young footballer. So he has all those elements. We can see that. We've seen enough already. But to ask him to go in and from the start of Championship games, almost go in and dictate and be the, have the personality to stamp his authority on it, I think is probably a bridge too far at this stage. And we've seen, you know, that he is finding it a lot tougher in recent games. And of course, you know, coming out of the Crystal Palace episode, that would have been quite a difficult moment for him as well, you know, to come through that. And he probably feels that he wants to, you know, put himself forward and project himself that he is ready right now. But I don't think he is ready right now on the evidence of the growing sample. But, you know, with Slimani, and the reality is, I think, without wanting to second guess Torrop, Slimani's fit yesterday. Slimani plays and Forson's on the bench. That's the reality of it. So he got a bit of a reprieve yesterday. I think on balance, it probably he didn't grasp his opportunity. So we await, you know, a more updated bulletin on Slimani's fitness as we move through this coming week. But I think what we saw at Coventry is in the here and now, if all the planets aligned where Torrop wants to go, and if that is the case, it would be Slimani, Nunes, McLean. And therefore, you can then bring Forsen along in a far more, maybe like he wants to do with Cernach to a degree, hence why he started Schwartau yesterday, in a more considered, give them a little bit of space, dip them in, dip them out, allow them to acclimatise at their own pace, rather than because of the situation that they're being exposed to Championship football a little bit earlier than they're probably ready for. And that's the delicate balance that Torrop and his coaching staff have to sort of navigate. But there's no doubt in my mind that he's not quite ready yet to be that frontline starter in that central three.
No. excuse me. I agree. And I think there's also a point about maybe where Norwich are at in their own development and having a player like him at this moment as well. Whether the team are quite ready for a player like that at this stage, it maybe feels like there's probably a little bit of misalignment between those two points. So and like you say, I think if Anish Ben Slimani is fit, and we'll come on to him in a moment, then he probably doesn't start. And it did probably feel like an afternoon, particularly in that first half, where they could have done with a lot more control, a lot more composure, a lot more physicality. So, there we go. I just wanted a word, Sam, and only because really Callum Doyle mentioned, name-checked him really in the post-game stuff. And we haven't spoken about him this season, but on El Hernandez, do you see a world where he is now knocking on the door for a start? Because you look at some of his contributions from the bench. I thought he was very bright, actually, when he came on yesterday and offers Norwich a very, you know, we've spoken about maybe the wide debate on all sides, really, but he offers Norwich a bit more of a battering ram in those wide areas. And that's not a criticism. That's praise to him. I think he's a different type of winger to maybe what they've got in the building. And I think by and large, actually, his performances under Torup have been, obviously, you've got to remember as well, was left out completely of the match day squad for Oxford. Crystal Palace, he played well. There was a good pass for a goal, and I can't remember, was it Stevenage? Off the top of my head, there was a where he was sort of in the left-back position and played a brilliant pass forward, and that led to an Norwich goal. Now, I think it was one of the Blackburn goals, actually, now I think about it. There have been some positive contributions for him. Do you see a world in which maybe we're talking about Onel Hernandez being a Norwich City starter in one of those wide areas?
Well, I think when you look at how some of the other options have played so far this season, it's got to be something that Torup is considering. The only concern I would have would be tactically and whether he feels that there's room on the pitch for Borja Sainz and Onel Hernandez at the same time, because although end product wise it was obviously not a good afternoon whatsoever for Sainz yesterday, I think in terms of the positions that he takes up, the roles that he play, or the role that he plays for Norwich, and the importance of him in there, I think he's pretty much far and away the starting option. For me, him and Josh Sargent are very, very settled in those two positions. And then you look at how Torup both has set up historically in his career and also how things work for Norwich. It's not often that he has two wingers who are maybe more likely to get on the ball and to take players on. And I know Sainz is more inverted, but he's still a bit more of your maverick moments winger than sort of an inside winger, like a number 10 type, like a Schwartau or maybe even a Siennats, who obviously don't have that same level of sort of aggression and directness in their play. I suppose you could have him out on the right, but then it's a concern of whether he's stepping on Jack Stacey's toes and leaving enough space for him to go around the outside there. So I think that's the only thing that's probably standing in his way and going against him at the moment, is that he doesn't give you that natural suitability for the system alongside Borja Sainz. It feels like probably you'd have to drop him to give Hernandez a chance.
Could you push Sainz inside into one of the midfield roles? We saw him do that in pre-season, and then have Hernandez as a more wide option. Would that help some of the creativity issues?
Yeah, I suppose so. And I actually liked him. I mean, it was chiefly where we saw that at its best, I think, was against Northampton, League One opposition, who themselves weren't at their best. But I liked him in that tactical role more than I expected to when I first saw that lineup. So I suppose it's a potential option. But then when we talk about the physicality that maybe Norwich lacked yesterday, if you're having Sainz in that position, I think he's, for all of his strengths, not really somebody who's going to give you much of that. He'll give you work rate and he'll give you tenacity, but you know, just physically his attributes aren't really there in that sense. So maybe there is a way in certain games that you can do that, but right now I think that's probably something where Hernandez would in a sense have to be crowbarred in. But I would agree with what you've said about his performances. I think for all the criticism that he receives and all the statements that he's sort of just a merchant for fan interaction and everyone loves him because of the tattoo, I think that is a little bit harsh. And obviously there is an extent to which his contribution is noticed a bit more than others when it goes well because people love him so much. But I think actually he has, as you said, performed pretty well under Torup so far. Maybe even been unlucky not to get a start yet when you consider some of the performances from some of his attacking colleagues. So yeah, I think if I was Torup, it's definitely something I would be considering. I just wonder if the way that he sees the game and tactically the way that he wants Norwich to perform, if it might be a bit difficult to find the best way to sort of get him into that team.
Yeah, I think if we're criticising a player for almost loving too much after the summer we've had with Jonathan Rowe and Abu Kamara, then maybe I'm not really sure how any footballer could win if that was the case. I think if you could have a lot of Onel Hernandez in your team in terms of what he offers with fan engagement and stuff, I think you'd take that. Paddy, and I guess maybe this leads to that point, and I agree with Sam. I was only floating the question, really. I think Norwich probably need a stronger midfield foundation if they were to push Sainz into that midfield role, particularly with Nunez in there as well. I'm not quite sure they have that at this moment in time, which probably lends us on to speak about Anis Ben Slimani probably in a little bit more depth, because you know, it was such a positive contribution against Coventry, and I think Norwich City supporters were probably desperate maybe is a bit strong, but they're probably really excited to see him from the off in a midfield performance. And then obviously you get the news and deliver the news of an injury. So first and foremost, just sort of tell us a little bit about that injury. And equally as well, I wonder what your reflections were on kind of Torup's words to you on Thursday at the press conference, where and you can go and look at them yourself. They now feel pretty pointed, don't they, about where maybe he's at physically.
They do, Connor. Yeah, no, I was just bringing those up, actually. I've got them in front of me. Yeah, and obviously you have to assume that towards the back end of the week was as Torup said to us after the game on Saturday, when this problem became an issue to the degree that he wasn't going to be available for selection. Hamstring related, let's just clarify that. That was his actual terminology. He didn't say it was a hamstring injury, but in that area, and where we are right now, recording it on Sunday morning, he didn't want to rule him out for Watford, which is the next home game this coming weekend now. But it did sound like they needed further assessment of that in the days ahead. They'll obviously all reconvene on Monday onwards at Colney. So not completely ruled out, but you know, reading between the lines, it felt like it might be a period of time he's unavailable. And to take it back to Thursday, yeah, well, I mean, I asked him off the back of Coventry, you know, that what have you got there in terms of a player who could really impact what you're trying to do this season? And you know, he was quite happy to volunteer that he sees Slimani as a player who can play 35, 40 games a season. That was his exact quote, which is effectively a starter. It's an ever-present. And so far in his career, which is the point we're getting into maybe now, he hasn't done it. And by that, you only look at last season, signed by Sheffield United, made 5 appearances, 5 starts. Wasn't huge body of games under his belt prior to coming to England, back in Denmark. So, and you're going into an environment where it's the relentlessness, it's the grueling 3-game-a-week cycles more often than not of the Championship, and then the physicality in Championship games. Yes, there's a technical level there, but you also need, and we saw it again, you know, with Swansea's approach in that first 15, 20 minutes on Saturday, that the intensity levels, the urgency, and the physicality required, particularly for a midfield player in this league, is maybe quite unique if you sort of contrast that with a lot of the top leagues around Europe. So that maybe is a question mark, because, you know, he went on to say, Johannes, that they have to prepare him now for that challenge, that they have to develop him for that, because that's what they need for a player in his position in this team. He feels there's some areas of his, quote, physicality in game we can improve. That, to me, is... it's not a slight on Slimani. It's maybe a recognition or an understanding that if you are going to be a Championship midfielder who plays 35, 40 games, particularly a midfielder in a Torup system, you need to have that physical output to your game to supplement what clearly is a very technically proficient footballer. So, you know, we will wait to see how this plays out purely in terms of this current fitness issue. But it did feel like Johannes was more or less suggesting that is an area he needs to work on now, not just him, obviously the sports science guys, the physical performance guys, and really build him up almost to have that robustness to withstand that degree of workload, which is not inconsiderable. So it was a shame that it's so early in the piece that, you know, we've had this sort of intervention that he wasn't available for selection. And as I say, we can't second guess now where we are in terms of how long he's going to be out. But there's no doubt that there are areas in his game in terms of the physical aspect that he will need to work on in order to be that guy who plays 35, 40 games this season. So, unfortunate, but, you know, you look at it and there is an international break now in short order. And if it was a period of games that he could miss then, or ended up missing, then I think we discussed it yesterday, you'd rather it was now at this early, relatively stage of the season than you get to the Christmas-January cycle where it becomes relentless, becomes a slog. You're really into the business end of a football season. And if he was still maybe not struggling, that's probably not the right word, but the physical demands were a challenge for him at that stage of the season, then, you know, you're probably in a situation where he's not playing regularly week in, week out. And it was underlined graphically yesterday that he is too good a player that he needs to be playing. He needs to be available to play week in, week out. So if there has to be a process now that's undertaken with all parties and all stakeholders to get him to that point physically that he can last the course and distance between now and May, then better now than, as I say, you know, 2 months down the line and he breaks down and his body's not able to cope with it, because we've seen examples of that maybe in Norwich shirt in recent seasons in those more progressive areas of the pitch where the technical ability isn't in doubt, but can they handle the robustness or the physicality and the rough and tumble at times of Championship football?
Yeah, and it is so grueling, and like Johanna said yesterday, something that he's not experienced, but as in Anas Ben Slimani's not experienced before in terms of having to play that volume of games. So we will obviously bring you the update of his fitness at the press conference later this week. Our channels are the best place to find that, and fingers crossed it is you know, the best case scenario is that he's available for Watford. But I would tend to side with you. That didn't sound particularly likely. I don't think so. Hey, hopefully we're proven wrong and he has an Emmanuel Forsen type recovery, which would be nice. Let's end with something a bit more lighthearted then. And as you said there, Paddy, only two international breaks to go until Christmas now, which is how I count down my festive schedule every year. But during this international break, there's been a little bit of a, I think, purely out of boredom from the lack of domestic football around a Barclays Mun trend, which I'm sure you gents have both seen. It's provoked a lot of conversation about who would be Norwich's peak Barclays Mun. I think we could all agree it's Wes Houlihan, but I just thought we'd throw in some others of nostalgia. And to be clear for people who have missed this, is that we're not talking about maybe the best players in that sense. We're talking purely on vibes and feelings, and that tends to be the way this is done. So for example, I've seen Mark Viduka compilations and Mort Gamps Pedersen and Adel Tarat. They're the sort of players that we're talking about. So Sam, let's come to you first. Chuck a couple of names in the pot for Norwich City Barclays Mun.
Yeah, I think when it comes to maybe not the most obvious names and the Houlihans and Grant Holt, probably the two that stick out to me the most are the two wingers that Norwich signed when they went up to the Premier League first in, well, not the first time in this era, but the first time before their sort of 3-year spell in 2011, when they signed Anthony Pilkington and Elliot Bennett, who I thought sort of epitomised probably that era. And I don't think it's a move that you'd see many Premier League teams make these days. Both of those players coming from League One and actually doing pretty well for Norwich. Probably Pilkington, actually, although I think Bennett has probably ended up being a bit more of a fan favourite and obviously spent a longer time at the club. I think Pilkington was actually pretty consistently contributing goals and assists and pretty good performances in a Norwich team that obviously was punching well above its weight. So those two, I think, are definitely up there for me. And although, you know, I think anyone who was associated with Norwich in that period would know about the main stars of that time. And there are probably more mainstream, more exciting names in that team. I think when it comes to that sort of that Barclays Mun trend that you sort of spoke about, I think those two wingers are really interesting, and on one of those probably worth keeping an eye on our channels in the next week or so.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely. We might be hearing more from one of them in very short order. But Pilkington, I think, is a great shout. I mean, I'm looking at his numbers here. In the 10-11 season, he played 31 games in League One and scored 10 goals. He then, in the 11-12 season, played Premier League football with Norwich and scored 8 goals. I mean, that's a pretty remarkable return considering the step up that he did take. So, yeah, I think Pilkington is a great shout. Paddy, you must have a few to chuck into the pot for us.
I'll just throw one in, mate. I mean, I was thankfully immune from this because I didn't have to get involved with it, as I was not.
What do you mean, thankfully?
Not that I'm curmudgeonly in any way, shape, or form, but you had the hospital pass on that one, Connor. I saw, I tend to throw it, or for me, my perception of it is more the cult hero figure of that period, and I'm going to go proper left field here. And we've touched on the season, whether it's relevant. Zach Whitbread, 11-12, came from Liverpool, came from Liverpool, so he had plenty of good pedigree there. So maybe he doesn't fall into that bracket of a player who's come from the bottom up. You know, he almost dropped down, let's be honest. But he played 17 times, which I'm just surprised. I've just checked it now. Sam was talking. 17 times in that first Lambert season, which was comfortable mid-table security. What they'd give for that in the last couple of dashes at the Premier League. But it's safe to say, I don't want to cast aspersions, but he didn't really live his life as the ultimate professional. I mean, I heard story. I'm probably going to slander him now, so I better get my legal team on standby. But
allegedly,
he liked to fry up and a pint maybe on down at Prince of Wales on a weekend morning after a game. So if that was the case, a player who was good enough to play 17 times in a Premier League season where they finished comfortably in mid-table. That to me is a definition of a Barclays man. So yeah, hat tip to Zach Whitbread. And he was just, as a character, you speak to any of his contemporaries from the Norwich dressing room at that period of time, and he was just, as demonstrated by that anecdote, which may or may not be true, but that he was a larger-than-life infectious character. So I'd definitely go down the Zach Whitbread route.
And if Zach is listening and he wants to respond to those claims, there's always a space available for you, Zach, to come on and do so. But yeah, that group of players, I think definitely Norwich had a few in there. So if you've listened or watched, let us know. Maybe others that we've missed out. I'd throw Dia Mercy and Bukani in from a different era, but scored some absolutely incredible goals. The back heel against, was it Liverpool in that crazy Liverpool game? That was memorable. And again, someone who maybe wasn't the biggest fan of training, but when it came to matches, really did produce. That seems like a nice place to leave it this week. Paddy, Sam, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you very much for watching and listening. We'll be back next week after Norwich City's home game against Watford. Hopefully we've talked the frustration out. Enjoy the rest of your week. We'll see you soon.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.